Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, part one of an entertaining documentary film called Love and Power. It's about Americans' naive beliefs that three things will increase freedom and democracy. These are individualism, computers, and unregulated finance. Each idea is a crock. Mix them together and you get Alan Greenspan. And much, much worse. I hope you'll stay tuned. I came across a really interesting documentary trilogy the other day. I adapted the first part of it to radio, and we'll hear it this week and next. The trilogy is by Adam Curtis. It's titled All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. If you're of a certain age, you'll recognize that title. It's the name of a 1967 poem by Richard Brautigan. The first part of the trilogy is titled Love and Power. It's about the interplay of some powerful social forces, forces that eventually came together to produce the great economic collapse of 2008. We start with the oddball novelist Ayn Rand and her philosophy of radical individualism. And we'll look at the once widespread belief that computers will liberate the people from government interference and empower a new form of individualistic democracy. And then the financial industry and its claim that deregulation plus computers will yield eternal prosperity and stability too. The world of Ayn Rand, the computer biz, and our financial oligarchs were all closely connected, notably in the person of Rand disciple Alan Greenspan, the powerful head of the Federal Reserve Board. It was all nonsense, of course. Rand's crackpot philosophy of individualism, the alleged democratizing power of computer networks, the alleged wisdom of unregulated big finance. It's all nonsense, and it's all connected, and it's quite a story. Here is part one of Adam Curtis's 2011 documentary, Love and Power. This is a story about the rise of the machines and how they made us believe we could create a stable world that would last forever. It is a strange story, and it begins with a strange woman in the 1950s in New York. This is TV journalist Mike Wallace interviewing Ayn Rand in 1959.
Who are you, Ayn Rand? When I say that, I would like to know just a little bit. You have an accent which is...
Russian.
Russian. You were born in Russia?
Yes.
Came here?
Oh, about 30 years ago.
And whence did this philosophy of yours come?
Out of my own mind, with the sole acknowledgement of a debt to Aristotle, who is the only philosopher that ever influenced me. Uh-huh. I devised the rest of my philosophy myself.
Ayn Rand had left Russia in the 1920s and gone to live in California. By chance, she met the film director, Cecil B. DeMille, who gave her a job as an extra on his epic films.
All right, now, give me everything you've got, you people. Ready now?
Speed, 957.
Places, everybody, this is a take.
Clear the set.
Camera!
Then DeMille gave her a screenplay to write, called The Skyscraper. Rand hated the characters and the plot, but the idea was going to make her famous. She started to write her own stories, and in 1943 she published a novel called The Fountainhead. Its hero is an architect called Howard Rourke, who refuses to compromise in his vision of how to build a skyscraper in New York. It was a bestseller and was made into a film. Ayn Rand used Rourke to express her philosophy that she called objectivism. Human beings, Rand said, were alone in the universe. They must free themselves of all forms of political and religious control and live their lives guided only by their selfish desires. If they did this, they would become heroic figures.
I am primarily the creator of a new code of morality, which has so far been believed impossible, namely, a morality not based on arbitrary edict, mystical or social. I hold that if man wants to live on earth, his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness, and that he must not force other people, nor accept their right to force him, that each man must live as an end in himself and follow his own rational self-interest.
May I interrupt now?
You may.
In the 1950s, Rand moved to New York. She lived next to her favorite skyscraper, the Empire State Building. Rand's ideas were seen as mad and dangerous. Selfishness and greed had led to the financial chaos and the depression of the 1930s. The job of politics was to manage and control the selfish desires of the individual. But Rand continued to write, and a small group of followers began to form round her, who believed in her vision of another kind of world, where everyone was free.
I was 19 when I met Ayaan. I was very idealistic, and she appealed to everything that was idealistic in me. We are heroic, we can know the world, we can tame nature, we can achieve our goals, we can do what we want. What does it matter that we're alone? Who do we need? Why do we need anyone? We have ourselves.
And that was enough?
And that was for sure enough. Yes, definitely enough. Even at 19, I knew I'm not going to meet anyone else like this. This is once in a lifetime.
Silicon Valley, about 40 years later.
Rand had died in 1981. But by the start of the 1990s, her novels had become a phenomenon in America. A Library of Congress survey showed that one of them, Atlas Shrugged, was now the second most influential book in the country. The first was the Bible. And the group most inspired by her were the new entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, including some of the most powerful, like Larry Ellison of Oracle. Many of them named their companies and even their children after Rand and her novels. They set up reading groups to spread her ideas. But above all, they saw themselves as Randian heroes.
I really felt like an Ayn Rand hero.
I really did feel like an Ayn Rand hero. I was one. I didn't just feel like one, I was one. I was building the products. I was thinking independently. I was being rational. I was taking pride in what I did. Those are Ayn Rand heroes' characteristics. I was an Ayn Rand hero. I wasn't in the book, but I was an Ayn Rand hero.
Just give you an example, my 6-year-old boy, his middle name is Rand. And I was talking to someone in a classmate's dad, and I was just saying, you know, we're talking about Ayn Rand in this interview, and he said, oh, I'm a huge Ayn Rand fan. In fact, my girl's middle name is Ayaan. And it's funny when you see people, you see companies all the time, you know, called Fountainhead or the Galt Group, and you see little evidence that Ayn Rand has heavily influenced people.
Many of the people here in Silicon Valley were greatly inspired by Ayn Rand. Entrepreneurs who were building computers, entrepreneurs in biotech, entrepreneurs in software, in internet networking. Many here were inspired by Ayn Rand. It presented a vision. It presented a vision of a morally exciting enterprise, a morally glorious project.
But the project was about more than just the entrepreneurs being Randian heroes. Because an idea was emerging in California that said that the new computer technologies could turn everyone into heroic individuals. It was a vision of a society where the old forms of political control would be unnecessary, because computer networks could create order in society without central control. This had never happened before, because at the heart of Western political thought had always been a fear that if you allowed individuals too much freedom, you would get anarchy. But ever since the 1970s, computer utopians in California believed that if human beings were linked by webs of computers, then together they could create their own kind of order. It was a cybernetic dream which said that the feedback of information between all the individuals connected as nodes in the network would work to create a self-stabilizing system. The world would be stable, yet everyone would be heroic Randian beings, completely free to follow their desires. Now, in the 1990s, the technologies had been built. And in 1991, a leading computer engineer from California gave a dramatic demonstration. He was called Lauren Carpenter. He invited hundreds of people to a large shed. On each seat was a small paddle, and in front of them was a giant screen.
We told them nothing for a while. We just left the things on the seats, and people would pick this up and look at it and say, "What's that?" And then somebody noticed that there's little red and green dots up there on the screen, and this is red and green, so maybe that has something to do with that.
That would be that. Okay, there I am.
And when that happened, the room erupted. Just totally spontaneous. We didn't say anything.
Carpenter then began an experiment. He projected the early computer game Pong.
In this computer ping pong game, a sort of bat on each side of the screen can be raised or lowered by a player to intercept a moving ball and bounce it back. In Lauren Carpenter's Pong experiment, each member of the audience is given a paddle with a red side and a green side.
Each half of the audience jointly controlled the bat on their side of the screen. If an individual held up red on their paddle, a computer sensor picked it up and the bat on the screen went down. If they held up green, it went up. But they had to operate it together.
When the game is being played and the ball is going back and forth, if it's down here and it's headed that way, some people are going to have to show red to keep it from going all the way to the top. If everybody just showed green, it would slam up to the top and the ball would miss. So something happened in that group of people where some decided to show green and some decided to show red to cause it to stop in the right place. And we have no idea what did that.
Carpenter believed what he had created was a model of a society where there was no hierarchy, where everyone made their own decisions without guidance. Yet because they were linked by the machines, out of it came a stability and an order.
So they're all acting as individuals because each one of them can decide what they're going to do. They have total freedom of what to decide to do. But there's an order. There's an order that emerges that gives them a kind of an amoeba-like effect where they surge and they play. It was kind of in the nature of an experiment. I wanted to see if no hierarchy existed at all, what would happen.
And what did happen?
They formed a kind of a subconscious consensus.
Out of these kinds of ideas came what was called the Californian ideology. It was an odd fusion of radical individualism and utopian theories about computer systems. And an international priesthood rose up to promote it. What united them was a vision that the world was now one interconnected system, that nation-states were irrelevant, and politicians should not try and control the system. They should let it free to create a new kind of democracy.
All the mechanisms that we are creating are connecting everything to everything else.
They let the individual do their thing.
The internet, as it spreads, is going to radically accelerate that process of network formation. The different kind of global governance.
really the fundamental evolution of the global system in the post-Cold War era.
And people, as consumers, have moved into the 21st century. New citizens, networkers, who reshape the world.
You have citizens forming networks, global, global society, planetary consciousness.
Where they are absolutely liberating for the individual.
Well, the power has shifted to the citizens, and the government must be a facilitator. They should not, in the traditional sense, control and regulate.
President Bill Clinton.
But at this very moment, a new president of the United States was elected who believed the opposite. He was convinced that he could use political power in its traditional way to transform the world for the better.
Forty years earlier, in New York, an economist named Alan Greenspan met Ayn Rand. Greenspan became a member of New York's small coterie of Rand devotees, which ironically called themselves the Collective. Years later, Greenspan would become the powerful head of the Federal Reserve Board.
Alan Greenspan believed in a philosophy called logical positivism. It was an extreme form of rationality that questioned everything and used logic to reach absurd conclusions. To try and save him from this, Nathaniel Brandon introduced Greenspan to Ayn Rand. Brandon and his wife Barbara were the leaders of the small group that had formed around Ayn Rand. They jokingly called themselves the Collective. And they met in Rand's apartment every Saturday night to read the latest section of the novel that she was writing, called Atlas Shrugged.
Nathaniel liked him. Ayn did not like him at all. Nathaniel did, and began discussing ideas with him. And every Saturday night, the Collective gathered to read what Ayn had written, to read in manuscript what Ayn had written of Atlas Shrugged that week. And finally, Nathaniel persuaded Ayn to include Alan in that. And he loved the book, and he became a loyal member of the Collective.
Atlas Shrugged is set in a science fiction world, but one which is very similar to 1950s America. In it, Ayn Rand attacks head-on the idea of altruism, the care of others, as an organizing principle for society. In the story, the government and the state control everything. But one by one, the creative individuals in America, the industrialists, the inventors, and the artists, are all mysteriously disappearing. They have gone on strike, and they hide out in a remote mountain valley as America falls apart. At the end of the book, they reappear and set out to build Rand's vision of the world to come. A world in which politics has disappeared and is based instead on what she called the virtues of selfishness. The critics hated it.
And let me start by quoting from a review of this novel, Atlas Shrugged, that appeared in Newsweek. It said that you are out to destroy almost every edifice in the contemporary American way of life, our Judeo-Christian religion, our modified government-regulated capitalism, our rule by the majority will. Are these accurate criticisms?
Yes. I'm challenging the moral code of altruism, the precept that man's moral duty is to live for others, that man must sacrifice himself to others. I say that man is entitled to his own happiness and that he must achieve it himself. Nor should he wish to sacrifice himself for the happiness of others. I hold that man should have self-esteem.
Atlas Shrugged was the great disappointment of her life. What hurt her terribly was that when it came out, not a single person whom she considered a peer stood up publicly to say what an achievement that book was. Not one. Nobody. Vicious, horrible criticisms. She felt very alienated. And this small group around her, the Collective, were the only people she had admitted to, in effect, her private world. The world where that she wasn't alienated from.
Alan Greenspan remained fiercely loyal to Ayn Rand. He married another member of the collective, a painter called Joan Mitchell. Together, they and the other members of the group saw themselves as models for a new kind of world that they were convinced was coming.
Oh, we thought of ourselves as being instigators of a revolution that was coming. And we were so enthusiastic about what a difference it was going to make to the world, and we were there, and we were in on it, and we hoped we were contributing even to it.
And what would that revolution lead to?
A totally free society.
At the end of 1992, Alan Greenspan went to see President Clinton. It was a few days after Clinton had been elected. And what Greenspan said in that conversation was the beginning of a revolution. By now, Greenspan was the head of the US Federal Reserve. And what he told Clinton was that his election promises of social reform were impossible. The government deficit was so large, Greenspan said, that if he borrowed any more to pay for his political program, that interest rates would go up and damage growth. But, Greenspan said, there was a radical alternative. Clinton should do the very opposite. Cut government spending. Then interest rates would go down and the markets would boom. Greenspan's idea was simple. Clinton should let the markets transform America, not politics. He said later that he was surprised that Clinton agreed with him.
I had hoped to invest in your future without asking more of you. And I've worked harder than I've ever worked in my life to meet that goal. But I can't, because the deficit has increased so much.
There will be many more budget cuts.
This is the beginning, not the end. The House has already embarked on that course. There will be more.
If our national debt were stacked in $1,000 bills, the stack would reach 267 miles into space.
As Greenspan had predicted, a boom began. And as share prices rose higher and higher, a belief started to grow that this time the boom would be different. It wouldn't run out of control. And the reason was the computers. The computers allowed the banks to create complex mathematical models that could predict the risk of making any loan or investment. This had enormous implications, because if a risk could be predicted, then it could be balanced by hedging against it. For the banks and the hedge funds, this was like a new world. But in the chaos and the volatility of the markets, the computers had, for the first time ever, created stability. It allowed banks to lend money to millions of people they would never have touched in the past. At the same time, the internet and other computer networks allowed businesses to respond to each other's needs instantaneously and to the consumer's desires. It was the cybernetic feedback predicted by the Californian ideologists. And a belief arose that America had now entered into a new age of stability. It was called the New Economy.
Whether they came from Silicon Valley, or from Washington, from academia, or from Wall Street, there were a number of leading individuals who basically articulated a body of thought now known fondly as the New Economy. That it was based on the premise of a dramatic and permanent increase in the rate of productivity growth sparked by new information technologies that would let this thing go on forever. This is a sort of manna from heaven. This is the candy that politicians only dream of. I mean, you don't have to do anything. You just push a button, and presto, you've got a brand new economy that creates jobs and prosperity. It's the rising tide that lifts any and all boats, even if there's no water in the ocean.
But Alan Greenspan was worried. Every morning in his bath, he read page after page of data about what was really happening in the factories and businesses of America. And what puzzled him was that the figures showed that actually there was hardly any increase in productivity. Yet reported profits kept on going up. There was something wrong. And in 1996, Greenspan made a speech that warned that the market might be overvalued, that a dangerous speculative bubble was being created.
Early December of 1996, Alan Greenspan warned that the U.S. stock market may be in a period of irrational exuberance. And you would have thought the world would come to an end. The politicians attacked him from the left, from the right. Main Street was upset with him. Wall Street was upset with him. And at that point, there was a very unfortunate turn of events because he knuckled under to political pressure. He changed his mind.
Greenspan decided he was wrong. That the computers were increasing productivity in ways that were so new, his data couldn't see it. And he went to see President Clinton to tell him the good news. It really was a new economy. Greenspan described it to Clinton as like discovering a new planet. Continued, and Time magazine described how a sense of lethargy and quietness came over the White House. It was as if the president didn't have anything to do.
And here we must pause. Next week, part two of Love and Power. We'll hear the whole preposterous trinity: radical individualism, computerized everything, and unregulated markets. We'll hear the whole preposterous trinity implode with a bang, with a little help from Monica Lewinsky. Who'da thunk it? From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes. Find an archive of all our shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimi non carborundum. Please come back again next week, and ciao.